words that caused shock and started arguments among those who defended his name and those who were scandalized by it. If a knight with Sir Thomas Blackstone's reputation was being taken to the citadel and the governor, then was the legendary knight about to be tried? Sir Henry Le Scrope was known for meting out harsh justice. What had Thomas Blackstone done to deserve it? The captain's voice carried to the sentries, who manned the citadel's gates, which swung open as the horsemen approached, and as they thudded closed behind them, Kildare turned in the saddle and looked at the defensive wall and the men who manned it. "The Almighty himself would have trouble escaping from this place," he said, "and just as much trouble trying to breach it through those outer walls. Thomas, I fear we are soon to be without the creature comforts of this world. Do you think that Countess Catherine made a complaint against me? I satisfied her lust with vigour. Perhaps she was aggrieved I left her. That would be cause enough for complaint." "Complaint, perhaps, that you were a wily old fox who denied her plunging a knife through your thick skull." Sir William halted before a set of doors. A court official came out and greeted him. Felton dismounted. "Captain, I would urge no man or boy to try and stable my horse," said Blackstone, as he dismounted, and tied the bastard horse to the hitching ring. "And keep other horses a good distance from him." "I will do as you ask, Sir Thomas," said the captain, and shouted his orders to his men. Kildare grunted. "Should have let the beast loose, Thomas. We might need a distraction, if we need to run. With that leg of yours, I'd end up carrying you. The day that happens, I would go back to my nun and let her rub olive oil into my old muscles and offer prayers that I live long enough to pleasure her." They were beckoned forward by Felton. "Follow me." Felton followed the court official through a bleak entrance hall, its heavy stone walls free from tapestry or decoration. King Edward's coat of arms was the only adornment. They turned into a passageway lit with cresset lamps, their dull flames throwing the men's shadows towards iron-studded doors. The court official pulled them open, revealing two armed guards who stood inside. Light shafted down from a high window, and freshly cut rushes were spread across the floor. Blackstone and Kildare knew they were getting closer to the seat of power in Calais by the increasing comfort on display. A fire burned in the grate. Upholstered benches and chairs were arranged near to it. Servants stood back in the shadows. A tall, silver-haired man leant over a table bearing documents. He raised his eyes when Felton entered, and let the document he was examining curl back into a roll.
"Sir William!"
"My Lord Governor," said Felton, to the severe-looking figure, whose clothing and demeanour were enough to proclaim his importance, even without the chain of office around his neck. Sir Henry Le Scrope was 50 years old, man and boy a soldier, and for the past year his skills as an administrator rewarded with the authority to govern his king's jewels in France, Guienne and Calais. He studied the tall knight who stood before him, and who did not avert his eyes. The two men facing him looked little more than unkempt brigands.
"Sir Thomas Blackstone and Sir Gilbert Kildare, you stink of the road, and your clothing is still stained with the blood of the French."
"My lord, we have not yet had the opportunity to bathe," said Blackstone, "and I remember seeing you splattered with French blood when we fought at Reims. A man bears the marks of the duty he performs, just as you bear your seal of office."
"Your impertinence does not surprise me," said the governor. "Wait here."
Sir Henry walked to another door beyond the fireplace and knocked.
"Christ, Thomas, do not antagonize the man who holds our fate in his hands," Kildare sighed, "like facing a wild boar with nothing more than a stick."
"Gilbert, they have not disarmed us. We are not yet prisoners. And when we are, we can use that stick to poke the boar in the eye. Let us not yield too easily in this matter."
The door was opened by someone unseen. The governor stood in the doorway and raised the rolled document.
"I have it ready."
He stepped inside when a muted voice summoned him. The door closed behind him.
"Where's Chandos?" whispered Kildare to Blackstone. "He might defend us."
"It looks as though the governor has already prepared our warrant," said Blackstone.
We are in the belly of the beast, Gilbert. Before Kilbert could answer, the door opened again, and the governor faced them.
Sir William, you are excused. Our thanks. Blackstone, Kilbert? In here.
Sir William Felton bowed his head and turned on his heel. No look of triumph crossed his features, but his eyes expressed the satisfaction that the rogue knight had been brought to heel. Blackstone and Kilbert did the governor's bidding and stepped into a vast room. The warmth from a big fire reached them as soon as they entered. Candles were positioned around the chamber, but there was sufficient light from another large window to show woven rugs strewn over rush floors and tapestries hanging to help keep out the chill from stone walls. An iron chandelier bearing 40 candles hung like a huge wagon wheel above their heads. Servants lurked in the shadows. An array of 20 or more court officials stood here and there. Sir John Chandos stepped forward, nodded at the two men, and then stepped aside. It was a room furnished for comfort, fit for a king. Blackstone and Kilbert caught their breath as King Edward turned from where he warmed his hands against the flames. His long flaxen beard and hair were shot through with slivers of grey. A second man rose from the embroidered chair that had been concealed by Chandos. It was the Prince of Wales. Blackstone and Kilbert went down on one knee. Kilbert grimaced slightly at the pain from his wounded leg.
"We hear you were injured, Gilbert," said the king.
"Sire, it was nothing. A scratch."
"Get to your feet. Sir John, help him," said the king.
No sooner had Chandos taken a step forward than Kilbert pushed himself upright, despite the discomfort. "No need, my lord. With your pardon, I'm not yet ready to be nursed." The King of England stepped forward, away from his officials, closer to the two men.
"You did not know that your king and his son were here?"
"No, sire, we did not. We were not told."
"Because, Thomas, no one knew other than Sir John and Sir Henry. What needs to be attended to here is a matter of grave importance, a matter that required us to travel here by night across the sea. The very treaty we have signed might be at risk."
"Sire, whatever charges are to be brought should only be brought against me, no one else. Sir Gilbert is here as a loyal friend." "You are not given permission to speak," said Sir John Chandos. Blackstone dipped his head, acknowledging his fault.
"We have received two delegations from the French king and the Dauphin," said the king. "They sought permission to hunt you down, and asked that we lend our support with the troops we have in France. The charges against the knight under the command of our trusted Chandos were of such serious nature that we were left with little choice but to give this matter our sincere efforts and best consideration. Over the weeks since the delegation reached us in England, we were caused much vexation. Speak, Sir Thomas. Explain to us how these charges came about."
"Sire, my men and I have done everything to serve your good name. I cannot know the exact nature of these charges, and would hope that, once I am told, your grace will give me the opportunity to explain." The king's face had not lost its stern look of displeasure.
"We doubt that will be necessary."
He returned to the fire, and a liveried servant quickly pushed a second chair in place, so that the king could sit and face the accused men. The Prince of Wales remained standing, gazing at Blackstone.
"Saint-Aubin-le-Feu," said the king, "a town ceded to us by the treaty. You burned it down after killing the lord who held it."
"They betrayed you, sir. The agreement was broken. They tried to kill Sir Gilbert. I lost good men behind those walls. I reported the loss to Sir John." Somewhere in the half-light towards the back of the room was the sound of a quill scratching across parchment. Blackstone glanced towards it and saw three scribes seated at a long table, copying down what was being said. "So, a trial it is, and the evidence is being recorded against me, questioned by the king himself." He dared a glance at Kilbert. Blackstone's young life had almost ended in a sheriff's court, where only his own wit and help from Kilbert had saved him. but this was no court of common pleas. Perhaps they were to be handed over to the French. How poisonous an end to be given to his sworn enemy, who had tried to kill him so often without success.
"Saint-Bernice de la Grave," the king said, "murder, rape, mutilation, and the abduction of the Lord's son."
Blackstone quickly related the events that led up to them riding into Saint-Bernice, and his pursuit of the mercenary who had hanged the young archer, and the fate of the brave young Frenchman. Throughout the explanation, the room remained silent. No comment was made by Sir John Chandos, the governor, or the king and the Prince of Wales. Blackstone began to feel his narration was sounding more and more like a troubadour's embellished lyrics.
"Louis de Harcourt gave a full report of what happened against the Bretons. There was some conflict in the telling by Sir William Felton, who is acknowledged as the victor."
"Sire, Sir William is an experienced commander. He deserves the credit," said Blackstone.
"And then the town of Felice. Slaughter on a vicious scale. The slaying of William Cade, the rape of Countess Catherine Duval. You destroyed the town and turned the Countess over to your men. The litany of crime goes on. Your destruction has cut a swathe across France. You recruit Gascons to your side, and then, with barely a handful of men, you strike at the Count de Tancarvel's army. Thousands of men, routiers, Sir Thomas, mercenaries, men of base nature, flock to your name."
"And many of them had served their king loyally in time of war," Blackstone said.
"Be quiet," warned the governor. "It is all right, Sir Henry. We have become accustomed over the years to Blackstone's defiance. It has served us well at times, and not at others."
"Sir Henry, defiance unto death is Thomas Blackstone's creed," said the Prince of Wales. 12 years ago we awarded him and his men their blazon here in this very town after he fought the French at the city gates. For that and a dozen other battles." The king settled his gaze on Blackstone.
"Our son and I have spent many hours deciding how best to deal with these charges. We have conferred with our Chancellor in France, Sir John, and we have given our assurances to King John and the Dauphin that we will deal with you appropriately. We also learned from our trusted and loyal servant in Florence, Father Torellini, that an attempt had been made on your son's life. We know the anguish of seeing a beloved son come close to death," the king said quietly.
For the first time his features softened, as he spoke to the man who had saved the young prince at Crecy.
"It was an act of courage all those years ago that has finally brought you before us in this room today."
The king gestured for the document that the governor had brought into the room. An official stepped forward, took it, then placed it on the table, unrolling its length, securing each end with a weight.
"During the weeks since these charges were brought against you, we instructed Sir John to investigate every one of them fully. It was an onerous duty laid on a man who was already tasked with bringing the territory and towns under our control. He had more important things to be doing, and he is soon to leave for Aquitaine, where our son Edward is to be made Prince of Aquitaine, and will rule in our name, under the direct lordship of the Crown of England. He will soon journey there with Sir John Chandos, who will be constable. The Breton War will not end shortly, and the Spanish princes will fight again."
The official spilled hot wax onto the document, pressed the royal seal into it, and bore it on a writing tray to the king, who took the proffered quill and scratched his signature. The tray was returned to the shadows. Blackstone heard the scratch of the quill again.
"You saved our son's life at Crecy, Thomas. And you swore an oath to our mother, the Queen, before she died, that you would serve us and the Prince loyally. Sir John has confirmed to us that the allegations against you were false. You are a man of honour and humility who does not claim success that is rightfully his."
The king gestured for the official to hand him the document. Edward stood and approached Blackstone. He held out the document that had now been folded square and sealed with wax, and pressed once again with the royal seal. Blackstone looked at what was written on the front of the document. The three words hurled his mind back to his village in England and the day it started, all those years before, when fate and its travelling companions, bad luck and misery, had visited him, and he had begun his own boyhood journey that had brought him to this place.
Sir Thomas Blackstone, you are to accompany our son, the Prince of Wales and Aquitaine, and to serve the English crown as Master of War.
You've been listening to Master of War, Scourge of Wolves by David Gilman. Narrated by Colin Mace. Published by Lamplight Audiobooks, an imprint of W.F. Howes Limited. This work is copyrighted David Gilman 2017. This recording is copyrighted 2018 W.F. Howes.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.